headlines, Iran reiterates that it is in compliance with the JCPOA after the U.S. said it was not sure whether Tehran wanted to come back into compliance. Iran urges the International Atomic Energy Agency to distance itself from any political agenda and avoid voicing artificial concerns. Also, Israeli right-wing groups cancel a planned march in occupied Jerusalem on Quds after the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas issued a warning. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, Iran's foreign minister says Tehran will or still does not know if the current U.S. administration is ready to change its predecessor's policies regarding the Iran nuclear deal. In a tweet, Mohammad Javad Zarif said Washington needs to, quote, bury the failed maximum pressure policy of Trump and cease its economic terrorism against Iran. Zarif's remarks came after U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Washington, which left the nuclear deal in 2018, is unsure whether Iran is ready to resume compliance with the accord. Zarif said Iran's gradual scale back of its commitments is in accordance to the terms of the deal, which stipulates that one party can reduce its obligations if others fail to meet theirs. Political commentator Frank Emspach says the lack of leadership on the part of U.S. President Joe Biden is the main issue hampering progress in the JCPOA revival talks. Here's more.
And certainly if one side violates the treaty, the other side can pull out. Well, the United States violated the treaty, it pulled out. And so the Iranians went to the Europeans and said, look, we still want to play ball here, help us out. We don't want you to agree to the sanctions. And the Europeans made some steps, but never put into real play the other trade agreements that they said they would do. So, you know, from the Iranians' position, they're saying, who are these people? That makes perfect sense. But this isn't a question of trust. This is a question of, is the United States going to do this or not? And there are certain clear indicators one way or the other. One of them is going to be financial transactions. Another might be not sinking Iranian ships, whoever did that. Another one might be to allow the oil to begin to circulate more. These are things that could be done as confidence-building schemes, and I think that's what everybody is waiting for, and I believe everybody has said that. Both sides have said that. They know, everybody knows, what specific things can be done to build confidence. This isn't a question of trust. It's a question of doing something. And I think the world, not only Iran, but people here, want to move here. I think there is a feeling that we should have some kind of normal relations with Iran. But unless that happens, unless there's some leadership, and the leadership is probably what the Iranian government is looking at here, or the lack thereof, and we don't see that.
Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says the nuclear watchdog has adopted a biased approach toward the Islamic Republic. Qasem Gharibabadi warned that such an approach could hamper future goodwill interactions between Tehran and the IAEA. He urged the agency to distance itself from any political agenda and avoid voicing artificial concerns. Gharibabadi added that the IAEA must take a clear stand on Israel's nuclear threat and place the regime's nuclear activities and facilities under its safeguards. On Monday, IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi accused Tehran of failing to answer questions about what he called the discovery of uranium particles at undeclared nuclear sites in the country.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA's Board of Governors, convenes a week-long meeting to discuss monitoring and verification in Iran, among other issues. Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi expressed concern over a lack of progress in discussions about the presence of nuclear material in four undeclared locations in Iran.
The Iranian government has reiterated its will to engage and to cooperate and to provide answers, but they haven't done that so far. So I hope this may change. But as we speak, we haven't had any concrete progress on any of the issues.
Iranian ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, says he's asked the agency not to use some unimportant issues dating to around two decades ago as an excuse to politicize Iran's case at a time when negotiations are underway to revive the nuclear deal between Iran and world powers, known as the JCPOA. Grossi acknowledged there's nothing that indicates there is a danger when it comes to the safeguards-related issues, but stressed that the agency would not stop asking questions. In his latest report, Grossi also said the agency's access to Iranian nuclear facilities has been restricted since the 23rd of February as a result of a parliamentary law that obliges the government to go ahead with enrichment and other nuclear activities and to deny the agency broader or complementary access beyond the country's regular safeguards obligations. Under a temporary agreement between Tehran and the agency, valid until the 24th of June, the IAEA will continue to collect data at Iran's key nuclear facilities via its surveillance equipment, but will not be able to access that data. Grossi said an extension of that agreement was becoming increasingly difficult. Iran says it will transfer all the collected data to the agency and return to full compliance with the JCPOA after the verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions. Omar Lizgi, Vienna.
In order to discuss that story further, I'm joined by Bruno Biclini out of Porto Alegre. He is a political scientist and professor of international studies. First question is, what's your assessment of the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency's warning amid the JCPOA revival talks?
I would say that the international agency, they must do not have a political agenda written by the White House or by the allies of the Zionist entity. It's of course they do have double standards, because if they press Iran for the more than sending data, what do they want? To stop the development of international of atomic energy for good, for developing scientific researches, for not defending the country? What are the hidden agenda is? It's about not stopping the sanctions, the U.S. sanctions, and going furthermore inside the country to establish a double standard and in a furthermore position to do a regime change inside Iran. Of course, Iran cannot allow the agency to behave like they are behaving themselves. They are liar. They are lying for the international community, they are lying for the international system, and I can't trust the agency as long as they not do the same thing in Israel. It's impossible to believe them.
Exactly, and as you said, Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, also says that this is politicizing Iran's case, as you just mentioned. My next question is, what's your take on future interactions between Iran and the IAEA?
I would say that Iran did all the commitments that were signed between Tehran and the past Obama administration. As long as U.S. betray the agency, they must have the first step. They must suspend the sanctions and then come back to negotiation. The agency must not reproduce inside the negotiations between the agency and Iran the hidden agenda of the U.S. and the hidden agenda of AIPAC and the Zionist lobby. It's impossible to go further in this negotiation like that. Iran is a sovereign country. It must not defeat itself for the agency.
Thank you so much. That was Bruno Biclini. He is a political scientist and professor of international studies, joining us out of Porto Alegre. Thank you so much, sir. Now let's move on. Campaigning for the upcoming presidential election is underway in Iran. Due to the coronavirus pandemic, election campaigns are held in the form of televised addresses and debates. After a raucous first debate, the runners will face off in two more debates to outline their plans. Yusuf Jalali reports.
With more than a week left to the upcoming presidential election in Iran, the rivalry gets tighter. After a showdown between the candidates in the first debate, Now they continue their campaigns on social media and national television, as the raucous debate revealed little information about the candidates' future plans. Reporters try to extract more details through these briefing sessions.
If we want to take strides in job creation, we need to pull the plug on sales of raw material. On top of them is crude oil. If one oil barrel gets us $50, its petrochemical products get us an added value of up to $2,000.
The upstream and downstream oil sectors have the potential to generate 880,000 jobs, but unfortunately, 25% of the petrochemical sector is not tapped into. If we operate this unused part, we can save $5 billion in petrochemical imports, and at the same time, we would generate thousands of jobs.
During his two terms as Iran's president, Hassan Rouhani did a lot with regards to foreign policy, clinching the 2015 nuclear deal with world powers, while retaining the country's intimate ties with its eastern partners, namely China and Russia. Now, as the Atomic Accord is facing a bumpy road ahead, most of the candidates believe it's not the master key for fixing Iran's economy.
The removal of sanctions isn't tied to negotiations with the U.S. We can instead neutralize the effect of the sanctions by tapping into myriad of resources in our country, such as rich mineral reserves.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. The second and third debates are scheduled for Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will be themed with cultural and political issues. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day on June 18th.
Well, the first debate was more pugnacious and less informative. It did not give a clear image of each of the candidates' policies. Now the seven rivals have two more chances to stand out and attract as many votes as possible in the second and third debates. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has led a military parade in the Gaza Strip after Israeli right-wing groups planned a march through flashpoint areas in occupied Jerusalem and Qods. Members of the armed wing of Hamas marched through the streets of Gaza City. The military parade came after a senior figure in the movement warned that the Israeli settlers' march could spark a new escalation in the region. The Israeli regime later canceled the so-called March of the Flags, citing a lack of authorization. Last month, Israel launched a war on Gaza after the besieged territory rose up in protest against Tel Aviv's escalations in the occupied West Bank. Hamas has repeatedly warned Israel that the movement is ready for any eventuality. The head of the World Health Organization has once again warned against unequal COVID-19 vaccine distribution, saying such a policy has created a two-track pandemic.
6 months since the first vaccines were administered, high-income countries have administered almost 44% of the world's doses. Low-income countries have administered just 0.4%. The most frustrating thing about this statistic is that it hasn't changed in months. Globally, we continue to see encouraging signs in the trajectory of the pandemic. The number of new cases of COVID-19 reported to WHO has now declined for 6 months.
Adhanom Ghebreyesus underlined that while many countries still face dangerous situations, some wealthier nations are talking about going back to normal life. He warned that despite a global decrease in the number of new cases, Africa, the Americas, and the Western Pacific are still seeing an increase in their death toll. The WHO chief also called on G7 leaders, who are set to meet in the United Kingdom, to commit to share vaccine doses in June and July. Political commentator Abayomi Azikiwe says without a joint international approach, the COVID-19 pandemic cannot be defeated.
I think it's representative of the narrow approach that the United States and other Western European countries have taken in regard to the COVID-19 pandemic. This pandemic cannot be fully resolved without having an international approach. And that is very much lacking on the part even of the Biden administration, which just came into office in January. In Africa now, you do in certain countries have rising statistics in regard to COVID infections. South Africa now is in its third wave. They're reporting 4,500 cases per day. So this is definitely a mounting problem. And even though the United States has promised to assist in regard to supplying vaccines, we see more effort being carried out by other countries.
Canadian police say a car ramming attack on Sunday that killed four members of a Muslim family in London, Ontario, was a hate crime.
We believe that this was an intentional act and that the victims of this horrific incident were targeted. We believe the victims were targeted because of their Islamic faith.
The police have charged a 20-year-old man with four counts of first-degree murder. An elderly woman died on the spot, while a man, another woman, and a teenage girl died after being taken to hospital. A 9-year-old boy was also hospitalized and is now recovering. The family was walking across a sidewalk when a pickup truck ran them over at an intersection. The National Council of Canadian Muslims has denounced the attack as an act of terror. Canadian law enforcement authorities are trying to also bring terrorism charges against the suspect. Felicia Gordon's for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
The 13th presidential election. Iran's 13th presidential election is going to be held on Friday, 18th of June. According to Article 113 of Iran's constitution, the president is the second highest official after the leader, and he has the responsibility for implementing the constitution and is the head of the executive branch of the government. The Islamic Republic of Iran system has been founded on the basis of participation of all strata of society and all social groups in elections. This indicates the importance of elections and collective decision in the Islamic system. That's why the outcome of every election belongs to the whole society and the whole nation. Those who participate in elections are indeed fulfilling their social, political, and religious responsibilities and duties. With the start of the election, the Iranian people demonstrate their presence in the social and political scene. According to the Constitution of the Islamic Republic of Iran, different officials are elected directly or indirectly with people's votes. In view of this, holding a healthy and enthusiastic election will enhance security and might of the Islamic system. In other words, widespread turnout in elections is one of the elements of the Islamic Republic system's soft power. Elections in Iran, in addition to national aspects, are important from regional and international aspects as well. People play a direct role in determining their fate, and through their votes they choose the president for a four-year period. In view of this, people's direct role in election has made maximum participation very important in the regional and international equations. Moreover, creation of an enthusiastic election requires warm participation of all political parties and currents. That's why Iran's Guardian Council, as the highest vetting body, tries to qualify as many candidates as possible from various political groups as possible to set the ground for people's massive turnout and participation in the election. This has institutionalized election as the ground for religious popular rule. This level of democracy has been unprecedented in the world. Of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei has stressed the importance of elections in various speeches. The leader said, "The vote to any candidate is the vote to the Islamic Republic, the vote to the system and the mechanism of election. That you enter the field of election, whether the presidential candidate or the elector like you and me, the very entering this field means trust in the Islamic Republic and trust in the mechanism of election. Furthermore, it is the vote to the one whom you and or that brother and sister or me have recognized to be more useful for the future of the country." Elsewhere in his remarks, the leader said, "Election is a very beautiful and attractive manifestation of public participation. It is the most effective means so that everyone is able to put their ideals, demands, and what they desire in the executive form and cause it to approach reality. If you choose a person according to your ideals and aspirations, the possibility of achieving those aspirations will become reality. The one whom you think is suitable for materialization of the demands and aspirations and opening great knots that you have in your life, once you choose him, you have in fact taken the biggest step to remove these problems. Any demand, whether material or spiritual, can materialize in this election, and being elected to office for the executive power, the head of the executive branch of the government." Sayyid Ali Khamenei believes that elections in Iran manifest the freedom of the people in choosing the candidate they like. It is not like some countries where it is compulsory to participate in elections and to vote. Even in Europe and Western countries, it is obligatory to participate in elections, and those who refuse will endure punishment. The punishment may be material or other forms. In the Islamic Republic of Iran, however, people go to the ballot box freely, and there is no social or state compulsion. They participate and vote quite freely for the candidate of their choosing. That's why during the season of every election, especially the presidential election, the media conglomerate in the West try their utmost to devalue election and people's participation in the election. They also focus their propaganda on the issue that elections in Iran are useless and ceremonial. That's why the leader of the Islamic Revolution has time and again emphasized on people's massive turnout in the elections. And he has also recommended that people to choose the best candidate to pursue the ideals of the Islamic Revolution and the ideals of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini. May God bless his soul.
food for thought.
Hello everyone, and we start today by contemplating upon a valuable piece of advice from the Prophet's sixth infallible successor, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him. Three characteristics bring about hatred, that is, hypocrisy, oppression, and self-conceit.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea
of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, a program dedicated to the memory of a great leader and the father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. We got to the point in this program where we've reached a stage where we've discussed the fact that Imam Khomeini, for those who don't have a belief in religion, will be an enigma. For those of us who do believe in Islam, he's not an enigma. He's the living essence and embodiment of the message of Islam. Dr. Hasni, very well, warm welcome to you on the program. Salam, and thanks for being with us. Yeah, really, we've enjoyed your contributions in the previous programs as well. But Dr. Hasni, as you quite rightly point out, and as we have said over and over again, you said that Imam Khomeini, a great man like Imam Khomeini, is like a mountain. And you said we have to stand back and take the tapestry of the context in which this mountain is located and look at the features of this mountain as well, in terms of its height, in terms of its appearance, in terms of its color. We talked about the fact that Imam Khomeini is a mountain.
You know, the problem with us is this. Mm. We only care about all five senses, you know?
That's right, absolutely.
In order to understand something beyond that, you have to go and try very hard in order to understand.
Well, let's go beyond
the significance.
Let's go beyond that. Let's do it. Let's make an attempt, even in our own humble way. As I say, we are not in any way going to fathom Imam Khomeini, because he was a man of God, a true man of God, the way of life of Islam as it should be lived by all of us. And as I say, I myself am personally sometimes ashamed that we are not the kind of Muslims we ought to be in terms of following the legacy of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, let alone following an example like Imam Khomeini. May God bless his great soul. But let's put it in this context. Let's now look at something that, as you say, is beyond those five senses. Because there is something about Imam Khomeini which is beyond those five senses. We talked about that he was speaking from a time, because he speaks from the timelessness of the Quran. Because you told us there's no boundary here, isn't there? It's limitless. So if we want to touch this hikmah, if we want to touch this wisdom, I want to look at the fact that Imam Khomeini has said things which, under normal circumstances, and I mean in the context that many scholars have not said anything different from what Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, may God bless his soul, has said at the end of his life in terms of the legacy of the Prophet being that I leave two weighty things, two valuable things, the Holy Quran and the infallibles, my family. Now, many scholars of the Ahlul Bayt, great scholars of the Ahlul Bayt, great philosophers from the school of Ahlul Bayt have mentioned this. But there are other schools as well, aren't there? There are other schools in the Muslim world as well, which also have their own reasoning, their own philosophy, their own understanding of the Quran. And they don't quite look at things the way we understand them from the school of Ahlul Bayt, and yet Imam Khomeini says the same thing, but the impact is entirely different. Other scholars have said before, but we've had many arguments about this, and there have been many controversial programs dedicated to this subject, that whether this is a sahih, whether this is mutawatir, is this something that really the Prophet was going to do, because he asked for a pen and paper in the last days of his life so that the ummah, the Muslim ummah, wouldn't go astray. Yet Imam Khomeini has done something which even I myself am puzzled by, that he has stated the same controversial statement, which, let it be known to the listeners, is not accepted by many parts of the Islamic Ummah. And yet, you know, we discuss this aspect of the
it's
life.
It's not the status quo.
Yeah, it's not the status quo. And we discuss the fact about the importance of walaya, but many don't accept it.
Mm-hmm.
Yet Imam Khomeini does the same thing. And we see his posters with the Rushdie affair. You remember that,
mm-hmm.
in 89, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
The Rushdie affair, which was a complete attempt to blaspheme the Quran, to blaspheme the Prophet by the enemies of Islam. And yet we see the fact that Sunni brethren are holding up the posters of Imam Khomeini in light of the fact that he has said something very controversial, and for many schools of thought is very difficult to swallow even to this day. And yet we are now seeing the fruits of what Imam Khomeini is saying. May God bless his soul, through the Islamic awakening. Tell us, brother, how did that happen? How does this dynamic work in this context where other scholars, may I say this, unfortunately, couldn't get that across?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brother Ejaz, again, so many different subjects. First thing first.
Sure.
Talking about the legacy.
Hmm.
The legacy it is, the legacy it was.
Was.
Mm-hmm. The legacy lives on.
And what it will be, what it will become.
My point is this.
Mm.
We always say Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him. This is his last name, referring to the piece of land, the geography that I was talking
sure.
to you about,
sure.
the last program. But I'm asking you this. What was his short name, first name?
Ruhullah.
There you go.
Yeah.
We always say Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him.
Yeah.
His first name was Ruhullah. What does it mean? Spirit of God.
God. And this is also a title of a great prophet in the Quran.
Exactly. You see?
Hmm.
And a title for a new book to be written.
Yeah.
That's what we can talk about Imam Khomeini.
Hmm.
Imam Khomeini lives within us, every single of us.
Yeah, he does.
The hope, the belief, the struggle, trying so hard to guide every single person on the planet. You mentioned the word Rushdie, supposed to mean guidance, and it wasn't.
Misguided.
Just like Pharaoh claimed to take the children of Israel on the right path, to the right path, and show them the promised land, and he didn't.
No.
He couldn't deliver.
No.
He couldn't come through clean, and it happened to him what he was deserved to be happen to him. So, Spirit of God is the legacy, is the power.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Spirit of God? Think about it for a second.
This is something now beyond the senses, isn't it?
Exactly. Because we are so entangled with material stuff, materialistic stuff.
We're blind.
You know the expression in the States, it doesn't matter what you do for someone.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about for a second, for the sake of argument, let's talk about in a relationship, a mutual one, it doesn't matter the male or female doing for whoever, his partner.
Sure.
She always asks, I'm talking about the Western mentality here,
because
we all live there, we know this.
Mm.
He said, by the way, what you have done for me lately? There is no satisfaction.
Mm. No satisfaction, right.
It doesn't matter what you do.
Mm.
Okay, you eat, you drink, you wear nice clothes.
Yeah, sure.
You drive nice car.
You trying to live a good quality of life.
There's no end to it.
Mm.
There is no saturation.
Right.
You always hunger for something. You're always thirsty for something.
Sure.
The Spirit of God, you have to pause for a second. What does it really mean?
Mm.
Why we don't ask ourselves, instead of saying, what you have done for me lately, what you have done for the reality, for the truth. Lately.
That's
or likely, like they call it.
Yeah.
What have you done for the truth, for the sake of truth? We always say, you know, this is it became kind of habit, and habit in the sense that you're not aware of it. This is not a good aspect. Okay, we always say, oh, for God's sake, for God's sake. We always swear by God whenever we need God in that sense, in order to fulfill some material needs of ours. We always refer to God, but who actually God is? What kind of attention we pay to this important matter? Why we don't ask ourselves, what have I done for the truth lately? Spirit of God helps us to understand that beyond this worldly, materialistic aspect of life, there is something else to think about.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that, you know, there are two, three elements that come into this.
You mentioned something about the school of thought.
Let me give you
another example.
Yeah, but what I'm seeing here is there's a combination of things in Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, which left others not able to say contrary to this, where they have been able to do it in the past. And this is what I find is unique here.
Brother, let me give you an example.
Because, as you say, the Spirit of Allah is like
I'm
going back
to explain that.
Yeah, it's going back to the fact that of the Quran, as you said, that these are those men who have made a pledge to Allah to give that correct pledge that they are going to do what the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, commanded them to do.
And it could be a broad way of understanding. Brother, this is a problem with material stuff, okay?
Yeah.
Think about a piece of rock, stone.
Okay.
Solid. This is the lowest level of being, okay?
Sure.
And in the agricultural way of living, we use soil, which is a solid.
Sure.
The lowest level of being.
Yeah, mineral.
We use it, mineral.
Yeah.
We use it to plant trees in it, vegetables. In order to make produce.
Yeah.
To be consumed by us, okay?
Sure.
This is one way. So solid for plantation. Then plantation is consumed by animals.
Animals.
Okay, cows eat grass.
Yeah.
They always done.
And always will do. Right.
Okay? Yeah. No matter what. No matter where.
Yeah.
No matter what century. Because last time we were talking about 20th century, right?
Yeah.
It's ironic to think about, oh, when we're talking about 20th centuries, we think we are so modern. We are so sophisticated.
Yeah, yeah.
We're putting a class for someone else.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
We look at different people, different nations. You are inferior. We are superior to you. Why? Because we live in the 20th century. But it doesn't mean nothing, the way I'm trying to explain it.
That's a very good point.
Solid for plantation. Plantation for animal. Animal for consumption by human.
Human.
Human for what? This is my question. This is a problem with the materialistic mentality of looking at things, okay?
From that
point of view. But you have to think about it. You have to think about it and come with a good answer for yourself first. You have to satisfy your curiosity and your need in order to understand, in order to gain the true knowledge. I'm talking about the true reality here. Because beyond these five senses, there are so many different things. We call it spirit. Spirit is not material. Okay?
Quite.
Remember a few decades away in Germany, okay, this doctor, whoever, in researcher, okay, this guy was passing away. They thought that they would come up with a new idea in order to prove that there is a spirit or there is not. They put this ready to pass away.
That's right. Yes, they did
on
that.
The scale, on this sophisticated digital scale.
Yeah.
They're trying to weigh the soul.
Yeah.
Or the guy who went to the moon said, look, what did you see on the moon? Said, I saw everything but God. I mean, that's a shame. That's very sad.
Yeah.
Okay? So, plantation for animal for human consumption. What is the role of human? What happens? He consumes. Then what happens? This is a question you have to think about.
Yeah.
Everybody has to answer to find a good answer.
So, in other words, we're going back to what we call in Islam, the fitrah. We are going back to this primordial nature.
The insight.
The insight.
Yes.
And this is what I'm saying, that Imam Khomeini makes that same statement, that same hadith, and yet the rest of the schools of thought are silent. And not only silent, they're picking up his picture, and they're also bearing witness to the fact mm-hmm. that this is a man who is the spirit of Allah of our time.
Exactly.
And beyond.
He was Ruhullah before he was Khomeini. Anybody mention his name back days, you know, mm-hmm. during the 15 of Khordad, you're talking about 50 years ago.
Mm.
They call him Sayyid Ruhullah. And Sayyid in Arabic is someone who takes care of the rest of them.
Takes care of the rest of them, right.
He's a master. He's a generous. He's a noble. He's a noble one. We don't pay attention, brother. This is the problem again.
Mm.
We don't pay attention to these words.
Yes,
we think this is only a name.
Yeah.
But name should have someone, you know, to be felt with.
But it has characteristics. It has a personality in itself.
It sure does. He was Ruhullah. Because he was Ruhullah, then if you are attached to God, in that sense that I tried to explain.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay?
Mm.
If you are Ruhullah, number one, you are not scared of nothing.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter how many enemies in front of you.
Mm.
You know, one of the titles for the commander of the faithful. He was Karar. Why? Because he was Ruhullah at the same time.
Precisely.
He was Waliullah. Wali what? He was connected
mm-hmm.
with God.
Mm-hmm.
And God is not material. So it tells us that we shouldn't be trapped in the sense that anything we cannot see with eye, with the physical eye, anything we cannot hear with this earthly ear, okay, vahy, revelation, is some kind of hearing. But not everybody is
able to hear it. Yeah.
So if you cannot hear, if you cannot see it, if you cannot touch, if you cannot feel, if you cannot taste, therefore, it doesn't exist. That's not the case. How come that school of, you mentioned something very nice, the school of thought.
Mm.
The school of thought goes wrong when you put an end, put a ceiling to an understanding.
Well, that's very interesting.
If you limit yourself to something, therefore you cannot go beyond, you cannot fly. And the sky is the limit, because God is a limitless being, if you will.
And he has to open a limit.
And I'm trying to speak so simple.
Yeah,
yes.
but you're talking about a gate or a door that has to open to this limitless
world. Exactly.
Wall.
That's why Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him,
says,
"Ana Madinatulam." I am the city of knowledge.
Beautiful.
And Aliyum Baba.
Baba.
Ali is the gate. And anywhere you want to, anytime, brother, it doesn't matter where.
Hmm.
This is the manner of doing. Anytime you want to enter a building,
hmm.
a house, how are you going to do it? You're going to jump from the back wall. You're not going to do that. You're going to enter from the gate. But the gate should be the correct one.
Yes.
Okay? This school of thought stops itself from solid. It comes to plantation, which is fine, which is true.
True.
Okay? To the animal level of being, which is true.
True.
And the relationship between each, which is true.
True.
And from animalistic level, you come to human.
Mm.
But you stop there. This is where you go wrong.
Wrong.
This is where you go astray. That's why you see suicide. In Islam, suicide is forbidden. You know why? There's a reason behind it. Anything God tells you, there is a reason behind it. The point is, you might understand, you should understand.
Sure.
Or, if you don't understand, you go look for the truth.
Truth. For the
there
hikmah.
Are people who understand.
Yeah, search for the wisdom.
Okay?
Mm.
And there might be a case that God is testing you, for example.
Sure.
But at least you understand that God is going to test you.
Test you.
There is no reason. There is wants to put your worshipness, if you will, your being a slave to God, your abd, okay, to God, by testing you. But there is a reason for it. In Islam, suicide is forbidden. Why? Because you don't belong to yourself. This body is not yours. It's only a deposit.
In other words, what you're saying is Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, through the Bab, through this gate of knowledge.
Even through the right ball.
The right
door. Something about source.
To the source.
I should add.
Source of the knowledge.
I should
which
add
is
to this.
Yeah.
Source is not enough, brother. Source, singular.
Yeah, but what I wanted to.
Sources
yeah.
is not enough. Pure source.
Pure source, yes. The pure source, which is the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, himself.
And he's the pure source.
The pure source. But the point I'm making here is that he said this statement, this hadithic clan, to raise the bar for the other schools.
And he did indeed. Imam Khomeini.
That's why they couldn't argue with this point, because as
you
say.
You know how you judge a person, a personality? You know how you value someone? When he or she knows his value or her value.
Excellent.
You are not yourself. You don't belong to yourself. That's why you cannot.
Yes.
You cannot cease your life.
Yeah.
You cannot commit suicide. This is one of the unforgivable sins of all. You can't kill yourself. You don't belong to yourself. This pain is not mine. Can I, it doesn't belong to me. Can
yeah.
I own it?
No, you can't.
Can I own it, then destroy it? I can't.
No.
This is only someone gave it to me, okay, for a higher purpose.
A trust.
A trust. Very good. A trust. This is our soul, back to Ruhullah.
Mm-hmm.
Our soul belongs to him. This is a divine source, divine spirit. Ruhullah in that sense.
Yes. And Ruhullah in this sense, in the sense of this great personality, has pledged the purity of this soul as a trust to fulfill that.
To the only pure
source.
To begin with.
Yeah.
To begin with.
To begin with.
And to end up with, of course, because we are all holding responsible in front of him, in the eye of Allah, is the final judge. Do you see that? It changes the whole story.
That has been the key success in terms of bringing the Muslim Ummah together to understand this importance of this concept of Walaya.
And if somebody follows this path, of course he's going to capture the hearts. Why? Because the hearts does not belong to you or me.
Yeah, because we mentioned that he's from the masses.
Brother Ejaz, again, hearts, mind you might manipulate it.
Yeah.
Okay, brainwash.
Yeah.
We
sure.
have that.
Sure.
But heart does not belong to me or you, or any government for that matter.
Exactly.
He
owns them.
He's the Muqallib al-Qulub. Remember the the prayer that
Please quote from the Quran if you
that?
Can, you know.
Muqallib al-Qulub.
Yeah, as an example.
Him.
Yeah.
And qalb is something that it constantly moves.
It's dynamic.
It's struggle.
Yeah.
It's dynamic.
Yeah, it's within the self-struggle.
You know, in a medical term, I don't know, I'm asking, all right? We all hear about the different kind of cancers. Okay?
Yes, yeah.
All different kind of cancers.
Sure.
So far, I haven't heard about cancer of heart.
No, I've not heard about
it. I don't know.
No.
I might be wrong.
Yeah, I haven't heard about it, no.
But if that's the case, if that
they
would
They call
be
it
the
heart
case,
disease, for example.
Heart disease, but
yeah.
not heart attack.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what
Heart attack,
say.
I would say.
Cardiac arrest.
It's something that you should think about, at least.
Mm.
You know? Because when you lodge it with someone, okay?
Yeah.
You can't push it. You cannot go further.
Yeah.
But the thing is, okay, if someone gets to know somebody, gets to like or to love somebody, which we're supposed to do with God, we have to get to know him.
Know him.
Okay?
Yes.
Then we have to love him.
Yes.
And the love comes from knowledge.
Exactly.
That's why, you know, all this, you know, earthly love is not true love. Okay?
No, it's not.
Why? Because there is so many different kind of reasons for divorces.
Yeah.
If you say you love someone, how come you beat them up? If you know the situation of love and hate.
Yeah.
You can love something, somebody,
sure.
and hate it at the same time.
Yeah.
Am I wrong or what?
Sure.
I'm just raising these points in order to think,
because
the subject of this program is to understand.
Yes. But God's love is not.
We are going to try to understand.
Yeah, but God's love is not in that context.
In that context. Okay? So, number one, you have to understand. Number two, you have to love.
Mm-hmm.
In order to prove your love, then what have you done for me lately? God can ask us this.
Yes.
On a daily basis.
Yes. And he has the right.
Again. And he has the right, because he created us.
Sure.
For what? He didn't need us. Did he?
No, he didn't.
He didn't.
No.
Why? He gave us favor.
Mm.
He did us a great, unimaginable, unexplainable,
favor.
Boundless favor. Mm-hmm. So, if someone give you a car, for example, you know, car, whatever the price might be, how many times you're going to say, look, I really, truly appreciate you?
Yeah. How many times are you
going to say that? If someone gives you, a camera, okay, how many times are you going to say, hey, guy, you're so nice.
Yeah,
to me.
You got
thank
it
you.
On Eid, for example.
But God gave us two eyes.
Yeah.
You know, what kind of camera is this?
Yeah.
It works for 80 years
without
repair in some cases, if you don't ruin it, if you take care of it, okay? But do we tell God every day, God, thank you for eyes. Thank you for giving me ears. We don't.
What does it say in the Quran?
This is the difference.
What does it say in the Quran that man is mostly ungrateful?
Brother, to make the long story short, and we can go on in the next program.
Yeah.
Okay? The difference between Ruhullah, between Imam Khomeini and me.
I'm
talking about myself here now.
Sure.
Okay? Is that he thinks about this stuff, and he believes in it, and he loves this stuff, and he acts upon it. Period.
And that's why
that makes the
nobody could argue with him.
Nobody can argue. Nobody can touch it because he's talking about the truth. You
exactly.
might hide the truth one day, one moment, but you cannot fool everybody all the time.
And I love the fact that, you know, you say this, and I love the way it came. This is another thing. It's not something that Imam Khomeini
the way it was to come.
The way it was to come. Thank you for that. Thank you. I mean, there's an order to this. There's a logic you can follow with this as well. That certain events happen over that 10-year period as the Imam was living. He puts it into a context where people are beginning to see the unimaginable, beginning to taste the unimaginable, the impossible. As you said right at the beginning, the impossible is becoming a reality in the late 20th century. And as we get to the end, he puts it, this context of this hadith, after we see the fall of communism. He's already sowing the seeds to show that this is the path we've got to go on after you see the collapse of this. We'll discuss it in the next session. But thanks,
God
Dr.
willing, we do.
Thanks, Dr. Hassani, for
thank
the
for
valuable
me,
contribution
thank
on
you.
This program. It's been really excellent and remarkable. Thanks a lot, because when we talk about this personality, really we open up some really remarkable doors. And it leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you all. And thanks for listening.
As the coronavirus continues to wreak havoc in India, some auto rickshaw drivers have turned their three-wheelers into makeshift ambulances to provide patients with first aid services.
Those are patients.
In New Delhi, the municipal ambulances are often occupied. There are also some very narrow alleys or built-up areas that are inaccessible by regular-sized ambulances. In these cases, our makeshift ambulances came in handy then. We attend to people in need with oxygen cylinders.
Mishra, who started the Rickshaw Ambulance Initiative, says his center attends around 1,200 calls per day. He says rickshaw volunteers transport roughly 150 patients during peak hours. The brave drivers work 12-hour shifts and mainly serve people with mild symptoms. They wear full protective gear, including face shields, while on duty. The three-wheeler ambulances are easily identifiable by the large printed image of the fleet and emergency call numbers. Mishra says the fleet will continue running with all its might until the coronavirus is under